The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to
discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group,
a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement.
Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. What's in a name? Well, depends who's asking. If you're looking for a job, you are 50% less likely to get a call back if your name is Lakeisha or Jamal than an Emily or a Brendan. In other words, if your name sounds Black. That's according to a University of Chicago study and reflected in the corporate world, where there are now just 5 Black CEOs heading Fortune 500 companies. Google revealed recently that only 2% of its global workforce is Black and 3% Hispanic. In the literary realm, however, sounding ethnic is perceived as an advantage. At least it was by Michael Derek Hudson. He submitted a poem to the journal Prairie Schooner under the pseudonym Yifeng Cho.
Here, sir. That's the very place Jesus wept. The Colosseum sprouts and blooms with leftover seeds pooped by ancient tigers. Poseidon diddled Philomel in the warm slap of this ankle-deep surf to the dying stings of 1,000 jellyfish. There, probably, atop yonder scraggly hillock, Adam should have said no to Eve.
That's just a bit of Hudson's poem, selected by guest editor Sherman Alexie for inclusion in the 2015 Best American Poetry Anthology. Alexie then discovered the author's true identity, but decided to include it anyway, and that is when things blew up.
It's complicated because Alexie is a Native American writer. He's, you know, been very upfront about wanting to promote other writers of color, just more diversity in general in this anthology. So he was quite tortured about this. And he came under a lot of fire, including from people who admire him generally. But he ultimately said, yes, he had given this fellow's poem an extra look because he had made the assumption that he was Chinese American. But ultimately, he really did include the poem because, as he wrote, I love it. And he said he was tempted, or at least thought about, dropping the poem because of this deception. But ultimately, he thought that if he dropped the poem, it would mean that the only reason he included any of the other poems that were in there was because of some consideration of the poet's identity rather than just poetic quality, which for him is really what it was about. He did like this poem.
That's Jenny Schuessler. She's Culture Desk reporter for the New York Times and has been following this story. Hudson has not talked to the press, but in his Best American Poetry author's note, was pretty frank about his motive. The poem had been rejected 40 times under his own name, but only 9 times before being accepted under the name Yifeng Cho. In other words, Hudson thought that he was getting over on the poetry publishing deck stacked against white men. That perceived advantage of ethnicity is something the writer Jenny Zhang felt acutely when she was at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, one of the most prestigious programs in the country.
Some of my white cohorts felt like they wouldn't be noticed as much as me because they were just, white people, which seems crazy because it certainly doesn't reflect that the age of white people writing literature and being praised for it is over if you go into any bookstore or read any major publication that has book reviews.
There is a decent contingent of white male writers who believe the social justice movement has put them at a structural disadvantage. As Gia Tolentino wrote in Jezebel, the fact that these white male writers are not the default anymore truly bothers them. This is not a demographic accustomed to being prejudged. However outnumbered they may feel, white writers are published and reviewed in literary outlets 9-1 over non-whites. But the publishing business is contracting and competition to be noticed expanding.
I remember one time this one girl was saying that I had an identity and an ethnicity that I could write about that people were interested in, and that she was sort of looking for one that she could insert and use in her fiction, ideally one that not that many people knew about, so that she could sort of have the same, you know, the same edge that you have because you write about your Chinese identity. Sometimes it would be very coded as well, where agents would come visit and meet with graduate students at Iowa, and people, you know, would just say, like, I probably didn't need to say much more than that I was writing about Chinese American immigrants in America, and the agent would be interested.
That's Jenny Zhang again. Her essay for BuzzFeed called They Pretend to Be Us While Pretending We Don't Exist joined the conversation that erupted on Twitter and other online outlets after Best American Poetry came out earlier this month.
Another hysterical white man, envious of the few people of color who've breached their quarantine. Michael Derek Hudson wanted to humiliate poets of color who dared to believe, however briefly, America wanted us, our whole selves. This guy calls it a strategy. It's actually called yellowface.
A sardonic white pen name generator appeared online, along with the hashtag #ActualAsianPoet and a fake feed from Michael Derek Hudson with posts like this.
I just realized I might have gotten two poems accepted if I applied as biracial.
Be sure to read my #BestAmericanPoetry2015 poem, Me Chinese, Me Play Joke.
Using a pen name to get published is an old tactic. Marianne Evans famously used George Eliot to publish Middlemarch and other now classics of English language literature, but that was in the 19th century. Jewish writers used pseudonyms in Stalin's Russia. In both cases, noms de plume chipped away at a system weighted against them and had nothing to do with the quality of the work. The poet Rigoberto Gonzalez told The Times that Hudson's ruse played into an anxiety among non-white writers, that they are included as tokens, which throws the question of whose work deserves to be published into the mix.
But I think one thing that's quite interesting is that a lot of the outrage on Twitter assumed that this guy was a terrible poet and that this poem was a piece of junk. And that in itself seems to me, and seemed to a lot of other people, to be a little bit troublesome. Why would it be assumed that someone like Sherman Alexie would have chosen a bad poem, or that a poem by a Chinese American that had maybe been given some extra consideration in the selection process was not in fact a good poem? And our poetry critic for the New York Times Book Review, the poetry columnist David Orr, published a very brief assessment of it in the Times, and he seemed to think it was a pretty decent poem. He didn't think it was a great poem.
Tokenism backs working writers of color like Jenny Zhang into a kind of corner. She's asked to comment and wants to because she's so offended. But discussing race is not the business she wants to be in.
Anytime a publication doesn't have enough writers of color, they'll think of me, or if a reading or a panel is composed of entirely white writers, they'll think of me. And I guess that's something that I'm supposed to be grateful for. But often it feels like a burden. It feels like I have to always be representing Asian Americans or people of color. I have to be burdened with educating white writers and poets. I'm fetishized for my identity and not paid for my labor.
Do you resent even having this kind of conversation? Because it seems like you have a real opinion on this from your essay.
You know, I don't resent this conversation, but I resent the larger world and society we live in, where conversations about race and racism are structured around scandal or controversy instead of sort of more thoughtful spaces where we get to talk about, you know, the ongoing legacy and continuation of racism. I'm not resentful, but I'm fatigued because it does take me away from the things I want to do. Like, I want to write fiction that's not about racism in America primarily or solely. And I'm sure a lot of other writers of color want that same freedom, the freedom to not be bothered. But that's, you know, a pipe dream.
One of the added stings of Michael Derek Hudson's fraud is that he could have invented any name. He was trying to gain advantage by appropriating a culture, not an individual identity. But his choice was personal on some level. Yifen Cho is the name of a woman who went to the same high school at the same time as he. For Jenny Zhang's family, choosing a name was a different kind of calculation when they moved from Shanghai and thought more American-sounding names would help their prospects at getting a job or prevent Jenny from being bullied at school. So the choice of a Chinese name has a different kind of resonance for her.
Yeah, this middle-aged white guy gets to have the best parts of a Asian or Chinese name, according to him, which is better chances of getting published. And meanwhile, actual Asian people are just trying to survive and not be made a target by hiding the names that they were born with.
American racial biases and economics have long benefited people with names like mine, which could easily have been spat out by the white name generator. Alexei's use of what he called racial nepotism led to a passionate, frank, and widespread conversation about inequity, yes, but also about poetry. Now, how often does that happen? At the very least, the flap may lead curious observers to take a look at what else is in Best American Poetry 2015. Or maybe to explore other collections or authors or threads to new voices and new names. Thanks to Jenny Schuessler and Jenny Zhang for speaking with us for this story. And there's a link to more in the collection and the passionate response to Michael Derek Hudson's inclusion in it at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Getting patients to take medicine as prescribed is a serious and sometimes life-threatening challenge. The manufacturer of Abilify, the world's best-selling antipsychotic drug, is working on a solution. They're trying to get FDA approval to attach an ingestible sensor that will track whether patients have taken their daily dose and report to doctors if they do not. This pill and tracker combination has been in development for some time, raising thorny ethical and legal questions, along with doubts about its success. Here's one doubter, Stephen Colbert.
According to the pill's manufacturer, Proteus Digital Health, the sensor can help patients suffering from diseases of the central nervous system, including schizophrenia, because nothing is more reassuring to a schizophrenic than a corporation inserting sensors into your body that beam information to all those people watching your every move.
Suspicions are high from the general public as well, after recent reports of pharmaceutical companies skyrocketing their markups on established drugs. So could digital upgrades be a tactic for raising prices? Here with more is Sarah Zhang, a science reporter at Wired, who wrote about the pill-tracker combination. Sarah, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me, Virginia.
So how do digital medicines work?
So how this Proteus system works is it's basically two things. You have a little Band-Aid-like sensor that you stick onto your torso, kind of right above your stomach. And then inside the pill, there's a tiny chip that's made of magnesium and copper. And when this piece of metal reaches your stomach juices, basically creates a tiny voltage at the sensor on your torso that can then detect it. And then it sends a signal to a smartphone, which can then also, with the patient's permission, be sent to their doctor so that doctor knows whether they're taking the medication or not.
So in this FDA application, is this system designed by Proteus? And the drug in question is Abilify. Now, who makes it and what is it used to treat?
Right. So Abilify is made by a big pharmaceutical company called Otsuka, and it is actually the most popular antipsychotic in the U.S. Just a couple years ago, it was actually the number one drug in the U.S. It's used to treat schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, in some cases, depression.
I mean, that was stunning to me that it is the number one selling drug in the U.S., at least it was in 2013. Is it being used for other off-label uses?
I believe it actually is just the most popular antipsychotic.
Wow. So what is the rationale then for adding sensor technology to Abilify?
The sort of easy thing to say is, well, we want patients to be taking their drugs in cases with people with serious mental illness. You're taking a pill every day. Easy to forget, you know, it's easy to forget for people, anyone who's taking a pill every day. We want them to be taking their medication. The other motivation that you might be able to see is that Abilify went off patent this year. There was kind of this convoluted lawsuit with the FDA where Otsuka was trying to prolong their patent. FDA said no, they approved generic drugs, and, you know, drug companies kind of have this long history of slightly reformulating their drugs to make them like slow-release formulas so that they can repatent it. And this might be seen as another strategy, that kind of strategy.
Well, what do you guess on that, that this is a way for Otsuka to extend the patents on this drug and probably raise the price?
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely, I put that question to Otsuka's officials and they told me no, that's not why. But I think we can all look at the timing and say it's awfully curious.
Well, any indication of how much more this version will cost?
That's a good question as well. The company's, you know, the sensor drug combination has not been approved yet. They would not give me any sort of clear number, but given that there are now generics on the market, and now you're getting not only a non-generic drug, but plus an extra sensor, you can probably expect it to be significantly more expensive.
Well, as you point out in your reporting, Jenny, 74% of patients with schizophrenia stop taking their prescribed drug within 18 months. Now, this is a real concern, especially at a time when calls to fix the nation's broken mental health system are reverberating in states and towns and in families across the country. So what kinds of civil liberties or ethical questions come with the idea of people who are psychotic, especially, tracking their drug intake?
Yeah, so what's interesting about not patients who, you know, fail to take their drugs is that there are many different reasons, right? In some cases, they simply forget. And the companies that are making this combination now, they are very clear to say this is what their pill is aimed for. So in other cases, you know, it's patients who maybe don't like the side effects of their drugs. In that case, you know, maybe this is a way to help those patients. The doctors can see they're not taking the drug. Maybe it's, you know, a way for doctors to know it's time for an intervention. In other cases, with patients who maybe don't believe that they're mentally ill, in that case, this system physically doesn't really work that well, right? Because you actually do have to be wearing this sensor. So if you don't want to be taking the drug, you don't wear the sensor, the system doesn't work.
And to Colbert's point, people who are schizophrenic or psychotic may be far less likely to want to ingest something that allows them to be tracked.
Yes, absolutely. You know, one psychiatrist I spoke to said you do have to be careful when someone, you know, might already be having these thoughts about monitoring. You know, how do you introduce this idea of monitoring them? And, you know, we're not quite there yet, but this is something that the trend is going toward when you start thinking about it.
Well, there's also a feeling in the air of mistrust, especially after recent news of Turing Pharmaceuticals adding a 5,000% markup to a popular toxoplasmosis drugs, news that other companies have raised prices on drugs over the past 20 years. Do you think the public believes that drug companies have our best interests in mind?
So, you know, with Turing, I think lots of big drug companies have been looking at them and trying to say, oh, he's not representative of us. This is a hedge fund guy, you know, doing his hedge fund thing. But definitely the problems of drug prices is a big issue. And you look in the U.S., you know, like we're one of the few developed, if not the only developed country that lets drug makers basically set their own prices. And you look at strategies in ways that drug makers keep trying to keep their prices high, it definitely does break down trust.
What about insurance companies? Is there a concern that tracking information could someday be used against patients? You know, you didn't take this drug as prescribed, so we're not covering it, or we're not reapproving it, or even we're raising your rates.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if you think in a lot of cases, drug might not only be useful for mental illness, but in cases of heart disease or diabetes. And if a drug, you know, insurance company can say, oh, look, you weren't taking the pill, so we're not going to pay for whatever outcomes that come out of that. If the sensor can, like, really work 100% of the time, then that's definitely something to worry about.
How about whether insurance companies or even Medicaid would pay for this upgrade for Abilify, especially given that a lot of people who are being treated for psychosis may not have insurance of their own?
Yeah, absolutely. And we were talking about generics and how, you know, generics are now approved and are likely to be much cheaper. Again, it seems like for now the drug is aimed at a very small subset of people, and maybe in those cases they might have great insurance that might pay for this. If insurance companies have a way of tracking compliance, they they might see some incentive in that. But for sure, you know, patients who don't have health insurance, seems like a hard pill to swallow to give them something so expensive.
Any other drugs that you know of now working for or looking to upgrade with these technological sensors or trackers?
So I do know that Proteus is working with a few other companies, Novartis included, and they have in fact tested it, the sensor system with those drugs. So these are drugs for other chronic illnesses like diabetes or heart disease.
Sarah, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you, Virginia.
Sarah Zhang, she's science reporter at Wired, and that's where we found her article, Why Farmer Wants to Put Sensors in This Blockbuster Drug. You'll find a link to read about it at our website. That's wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Once the customary hairstyle of ballerinas and librarians, the bun has been making a comeback, this time on the heads of lads. Man buns have topped the heads of Hollywood stars Jared Leto, Jake Gyllenhaal, and occasionally Chris Hemsworth, and have trickled down to the streets of Brooklyn, L.A., Portland, and as the extremely popular Man Buns of Disneyland Instagram account proves, Middle America. Disneyland? Have we reached peak man bun? Well, James Corden, host of The Late Late Show, is ready to cut the trend.
The first thing we're kicking out, guys, man buns. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah, it's time. Now, okay, I hear what you're saying. Now, Harry Styles and Leonardo DiCaprio, they can get away with it, but guys, they can get away with anything. Okay?
And that was in April. As anyone walking through Williamsburg or Bushwick can see today, his plea has fallen on deaf ears. Phil Edwards is writer at Vox, where he covers all manner of ephemera, so it's only fitting that he would give us an explainer on the man bun. Phil, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so what is the man bun exactly?
Yeah, so that's actually a little bit of a trickier question than you'd think. It's kind of a flexible term. I define it as any situation in which there's a bit of hair on the top of the head that is tied back and sits somewhere high on the head. So it's not a low ponytail, and it's usually appearing as a kind of bun, but that can have a huge range, whether it's a ton of hair being pulled back or whether it's a tiny little shoot of hair that somebody manages to corral into a little mini bun that they wear.
So a lot of variations to this situation, as you put it, and not even limited to men with long hair.
Yeah, no, there's one variation in which a little shoot of hair pokes from the top of the head, and it's called the pineapple. And you know, what it lacks in grace, it makes up for in just being technically a man bun. So they have that bit of cred that they can have. There's also something called a top knot, which, you know, lots of people are familiar with from other versions of the top knot or other times people have worn it. But sometimes in the man bun, that can mean a very little short shoot of hair that's kind of poking out from the back of the head, like a little bristle brush.
Or I think of sumo wrestlers, the traditional style of the sumo wrestler.
Yeah, yeah, that's definitely what it looks like, though occasionally that'll involve shaving the front of the head, so, you know, charting out exactly where the man bun fits in there is a little more difficult. It might be its own invention.
Were you able to trace the genesis of this trend? You know, the kind of hairstyle patient zero of the man bun?
Yeah, it's kind of tricky figuring out exactly when it started, but I think to understand the man bun as it's being talked about today, which is sort of this hipster phenomenon, it's surprisingly recent. You have to go back to maybe about 2011 when you started to see some tweets pop up, and then mainstream media reports occurred around 2012. So obviously there have been some men who have worn their hair long for centuries, but the man bun phenomenon as a hipster badge is pretty new, which I thought was interesting because you'd think it would show up sooner, but since 2012, it's just been on a really fast rise, and it's kind of started bubbling up everywhere. And I think it hit the tipping point late last year and became a mainstream phenomenon.
I think of Jared Leto at the Oscars. I can't remember which year that was, maybe 2013.
Yeah, definitely. He and a few other actors who I at least think had to have long hair for their roles. So he had long hair for, I think it was for Dallas Buyers Club, and I think that might have coincided with the first appearance of his man bun. And then you have Chris Hemsworth as Thor and a few other people who sort of had to have man buns, and I think maybe them being the public ambassadors of this hairstyle helped get it into public view. But at the same time, these early media reports that I saw, they were citing, you know, Brooklyn bartenders and really cool people in San Francisco as being the progenitors of the trend. So I think it's probably a mix of celebrities and also just cutting-edge hipsters who wanted to figure out the best new haircut that could really stand out.
But there seem to be so few really specific hairstyle trends for men. We think of the crew cut, the Ken doll, the kind of faux hawk, or remember the Caesar haircut?
Yeah.
What do you think it is that makes a hairstyle stick for men?
Well, I think, you know, I have a theory that the man bun benefits from the fact that the previous cool haircut was one in which the hair is a little longer on top and then it's cut very close on the sides, sort of looks like Boardwalk Empire or something like that, depending on how you look at it. And my theory is that a hot man's haircut, the type of man's haircut that really stands out, is one that can be easily grown out from the previous trendy haircut. And so that makes it possible for a lot of people to adopt the haircut relatively quickly, yet it's different enough that they can claim that they're setting some sort of trend. And in the case of the man bun, it really, really helps that there's a catchy name that lots of people can point out and, of course, occasionally make fun of.
It's funny because the long hair on men in general has become a kind of anti-trend, right? You know, this once popular male ponytail has evolved to have several connotations. We think, you know, unrepentant hippie or vain peacock or compensating for baldness or someone who's just given up. Do you think there's any kind of meaning or statement associated with the man bun?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what's interesting about it. In the past couple of days, people have been pointing out to me in the 80s, a low ponytail that's not exactly like a man bun, but like an executive ponytail, and it was often called the dork knob. And so, obviously, there are people who are really anti-ponytail, anti-bun, or any sort of long hair. And so I think that now the man bun is sort of bucking what has become conventional, which is that really short, sort of slicked back hair, and it's become rebellious again. Like, not everybody can go into work wearing a man bun, whereas everybody can go into work these days wearing a beard, for example, or a really short haircut that just a few years ago might have been a statement. So for me, it's not so much that we've discovered that luscious locks are the path to enlightenment. It's that we've found out that the way to make a statement, the way to stand out, is through something like a man bun because it's so different and it has been maligned.
Phil, there's a kind of hatred bordering on cruel. You know, there's a stop the knot movement, vigilantes driving around, cutting them off of people. Why so hated?
I think that shows in a way that the trend has struck a chord. The fact that the man bun is weird enough to be a bit of a statement is what gives it its appeal. So I think that might be the reason that people dislike it so much. And just, there are a lot of issues that are bundled into the man bun. There's ideas that it might be pushing boundaries as far as what's masculine or not masculine. There's sort of vanity involved. And then there's the fact that, you know, this has been a bun for a lot of people for many, many years, and suddenly it becomes a man bun and it's the hot new haircut. So I think all that is kind of bundled together. And then finally, you have the fact that occasionally some people don't know how to care for their man buns and they can get a little greasy.
Well, Phil, I'm so glad we got to the bottom of this.
Yes.
Thank you.
And it'll keep growing out.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Phil Edwards is a writer at Vox.com, which is where we found his article, Man Buns Explained. And you'll find a primer for yourself and see a slideshow of some truly spectacular man buns. It's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Do I look better with a man bun? Do you want to touch my
man bun?
I look good with a
man bun.
Don't be jealous of a
man bun.
Man bun.
Man plus bun.
pay no one.
Do I look better with a man bun?
Okay, more proof this weekend when I walked through H&M in Boston and saw packets of cloth elastics in the men's section. Yep, that's right. Well, if you have no wish to jump on the man bun bandwagon, maybe it's time to visit your friendly neighborhood barber. Producer Casey Herman from Salt Radio brings us the story of a barber in Maine who was a fixture in his small town.
If you are a guy looking for a haircut in Madison, Maine, there's a place you'll probably end up.
Buzzy's Barbershop, 75 Main Street, Madison, Maine. Hair removed while you wait.
This is Freeman Buzzle.
Actually, 90% of people only know me as Buzzy. Probably almost everybody with the last name Buzzle ends up Buzzy, I think.
It's a great nickname if you also happen to be a barber. And for 55 years, Buzzy's been cutting hair. His own hair is white, neatly trimmed. He's wearing a black shirt with an embroidered logo that says Buzzy's Barbershop. It's clear that he is a Madison institution.
I'd say the whole Central Maine knows Buzzy.
Been coming here ever since I was a kid, ever since I can remember. So.
45 years since I came to town, yeah. We hear a little story, and we lie to each other a little bit.
Men from Madison have made a visit to Buzzy a family tradition.
My other son and my grandson are regulars here.
And sitting through a haircut as a kid still earns you a lollipop. The profession of barbering has been on the decline in Maine. All the other barbers in Madison are gone. But Buzzy, dedicated to his customers, has kept his shop open. He enjoys barbering, and he enjoys being that traditional space for men. In a town that's been hit by hard times, where most everything else has changed, his barbershop is a constant, a fixture on Main Street. Buzzy knows that it's more than just a place for guys to get their haircut.
Kind of a important social thing for a lot of people. Usually they come in and run into some friends or somebody that they enjoy talking to and still talk about hunting, fishing, who's got the biggest deer and who's got skunked and almost going through the ice because it was thinner than they thought.
They're the same kind of stories the men told in 1960 when Buzzy signed up for a 2-year machinist course after finishing high school. But that summer,
kind of decided that maybe barber school would be better because I'd be done in a year instead of 2 years and I could buy a new car a year sooner, which is kind of a silly reason, but never regretted it.
Buzzy bought his own barber chair and opened his own shop. He joined 4 other barbers in town.
Back then there was like 5 of us all together and there was a gentleman's agreement that we'd all keep the same hours and charge the same prices, but it wasn't really a union. Think a dollar and a half.
Madison in the 60s was a prosperous, booming town. At the town's biggest employer, the paper mill, workers could make a good living.
Friday night, people used to come to town early to get a good parking spot because all the stores stayed open Friday night. Probably dozens of places you could get a job tomorrow with no trouble.
Bob Demchek sits in the barber chair, and Buzzy is tapering his white hair, a classic men's style. It's the same chair Bob sat in as a kid. He moved away from Madison in 69. When he moved back 11 years ago, he saw that Madison had changed.
The town had died. When I grew up here, the mill employed a whole lot more people than it does today because of the technology. You know, you look out the window right here, there used to be a very booming wholesale company, Christopher's. Main Street, all the stores that used to be here are closed, gone, buildings are boarded up. It's all gone. There's nothing here to keep the young folks.
Kyle Bishop is one of those young folks. He's 29, grew up in the area, and he has stayed. He has a job working for a railroad, but he says, yeah, it's difficult.
It's getting harder and harder for people to make a living around here. Just, you know, make things overseas and ship them over here a lot cheaper than people over here can work and make them. And I don't leave the house too much. I try to stay in and pretty much save money where I can.
Buzzy heard about the hard times from the customers in his chair, and he saw the town change too. Then in 2008, after 45 years in the same shop, something happened that affected him directly.
The landlord kind of went out of business, and I didn't want to go to the trouble of moving. But I didn't have an option at the end, had to move.
Buzzy could have taken the opportunity to retire. In fact, as older barbers retire and fewer younger ones take up the profession, the number of licensed barbers in Maine has dropped by close to 40% in the past 15 years. But instead of retiring, Buzzy's still on Main Street today. He moved into the building directly next door to his old shop, just one door down, and kept on cutting hair.
Don't really even need to work, but I'd miss all the customers. Basically, you get to be friends with a good part of your customers, so it's never get bored. Always got somebody to talk to, and barbers are getting to be like dinosaurs. Oh, there was four others besides me when I got here, and they've all been gone over 15 years, possibly even 20. I'm the only barber right on 201, probably all the way to Canada now.
Just take the gray hair off, Buzz.
Okay. I'll only cut the gray ones to run. Yeah.
Buzzy still doesn't have any plans to retire which makes his customers happy.
I ask him pretty near every time I come over, when you going to retire? He says, I don't think I'll ever retire, he says.
But then I have to pull it back.
Unfortunately for Madison, when Buzzy does decide to hang up his clippers, another barber has already contacted him about taking over the shop.
Yeah, if he gives me the right kind of offer, he might own it.
For now, being the only barber left in town has one big practical drawback.
Yeah, we used to, you know, we just swapped haircuts. Now that they're all gone, it's hard to find a barber. I know I could make myself happy if I could only take my head off and work on it, but I can't.
For Salt Radio, I'm Casey Herman.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Flying is the worst one because people come back from flights and they tell you their story. And it's like a horror story. It's they act like their flight was like a cattle car in the 40s in Germany. That's how bad they make it sound.
Right.
They're like, it was the worst day of my life. First of all, we didn't board for 20 minutes. Right. And then we get on the plane and they made us sit there on the runway for 40 minutes. We had to sit there. Oh, really? What happened next? Did you fly through the air incredibly like a bird? Did you partake in the miracle of human flight, you non-contributing zero, that you got to fly? You're flying! It's amazing!
That's the comedian Louis C.K. with Conan O'Brien arguing that the miracle of human flight should be the only thing on your mind while you're in the air. Still, if you've ever felt crammed into a seat and grumbled that flying is not what it used to be, you have a point. Since the deregulation of the airline industry in the 1970s, both seat pitch, that's the official term for what most of us think of as legroom, and seat width have measurably decreased, leading to crowded conditions in economy class cabins. But is it a human rights issue? Well, one organization says yes. Paul Hudson is an attorney and a public interest advocate and president of FlyersRights.org and joins us now to explain the proposed Flyers Bill of Rights. Paul, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Well, thank you for having me.
So Flyers Rights has petitioned the government to create regulations for minimum seat pitch and width. So what are the ideal measurements?
Well, we're asking that there be standard minimum regulations for seat width and for passenger space. The seats that we have now were designed in the 1950s, and the average person has gotten bigger, and the average person's gotten older, and the seats have gotten smaller. So for now, the average man's shoulders are wider than the seats. What we are looking to is to have the seat width and space, first of all, not be a safety hazard. Secondly, not be a health hazard because blood clots are becoming more common with cramped seating. And thirdly, of course, that we have at least a minimum level of comfort.
How many people have signed the petition so far?
We have approximately 30,000 people that have indicated support. And we filed a formal rulemaking petition with the FAA at the end of last month. And they have 6 months in which to decide that. And in the meantime, we're asking for a moratorium on any further shrinkage because the airlines are now more aggressively than ever actually shrinking seat size.
And a passenger's Bill of Rights has been stalled in Congress since 1999. What sort of conditions are listed on that bill?
Well, there's probably about 20 bills that have been introduced over the years that call themselves Bill of Rights. We issued our proposals back in 2012. One thing that we did propose that did get enacted in 2009 was what's now called the three-hour rule. The airlines used to keep about 250,000 people a year confined on the tarmac. People were being confined as long as 10 or 12 hours. And under the three-hour rule, they cannot go over 3 hours.
Well, I do certainly hope that your bill goes forward for more space, certainly. But is having more room on an airplane really a human right?
Well, we have regulations for animals on planes. They're required to have a certain minimum amount of space. We have regulations for prisoners, but we don't seem to have any regulations for able-bodied passengers.
Well, when I do think of human rights needing protection right now, I'm thinking of, you know, refugees drowning on boats in the Mediterranean. It does seem on some level that having the proper amount of space during flying is a bit of a luxury problem.
Well, I suppose you could consider it, but if you look back in history, when we had no seat regulations or we had no accommodations regulations generally for long-distance passengers, we go back to the time of the Titanic. And then we had what was called steerage class. And I'm afraid if we don't get some minimum regulations now, that's where we're headed.
But you are pointing to more room is available if you pay more money, even in economy class. How much more money on the average to sit in a space with more legroom?
It can increase your airfare by 50% for maybe getting 2 or 3 inches. And it's not always available. If you go to business or first class, which isn't necessarily available on some airlines like Southwest, for instance, that has the largest number of flights, then you're talking about fares that are 3 to 5 times as much.
Paul Hudson, how tall are you, by the way?
I used to be 6'1", but I've gotten older. I'm probably just about 6'4", a little less.
Still a challenge sitting in an airline seat in economy class, I imagine, for you.
You know, it is uncomfortable. I mean, particularly when you're in the middle seat, and it's more than uncomfortable for many people. About 10% of passengers now are over 6'2", or they weigh over 250 pounds. And for those passengers, the only way they can fit is if they encroach on other people's space.
Well, Paul, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Paul Hudson, he's president of FlyersRights.org. That's an organization petitioning Congress to pass a Flyers Bill of Rights. You can find more about them at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org, including the Word of Mouth podcast, so you never miss an episode. You can also find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR on iTunes. And if you like that kind of convenience, do us a favor and write a review or rate it on iTunes. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we'll be back tomorrow, too, with more Word of Mouth here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan, and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.
Ben's got ears of them here. Ben's got eyes of them see. Turn your eyes to the Lord of the skies. Take this airline plane, it'll take you home again.